KBOO Portland, good morning. It's 8:59. Coming up, Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell.
You know you love KBOO's programming, but did you know you can help inform decisions about new programs on KBOO? Support evaluating shows to ensure programming excellence, as well as help process feedback about shows from our listeners. Well, you can when you join the KBOO Programming Advisory Committee. All you need to be is a KBOO member. Attend monthly meetings on the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. at KBOO, and commit 5 hours a month to work on committee-related tasks. The Programming Advisory Committee works alongside KBOO programming staff to live out our programming charter. You can find out more at kboo.fm/committees. See you the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. KBOO needs you.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock in Cascadia, and you're listening to Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Well, I want to talk a little bit about the contract negotiations for the Portland police also. But first, I want to move to other headlines. You have perhaps heard that Hurricane Matthew has struck Haiti. And so I imagine that you will also be seeing appeals for donations from the Red Cross, not just for Haiti. It's about to hit Florida. It looks like it's headed towards Palm Beach or maybe Miami. So we'll be hearing a lot about Hurricane Matthew, but first I want to bring up a blast from the past, an article in ProPublica.org about how the Red Cross raised $500 million for Haiti and built six, count them, six homes. They write, in late 2011, the Red Cross launched a multi-million-dollar project to transform the desperately poor area of Port-au-Prince, which was hit hard by the earthquake that struck Haiti. The year before, the main focus of the project, called La Mica, an acronym in Creole for A Better Life in My Neighborhood, was building hundreds of permanent homes. Today, not one home has been built in Campeche. Many residents live in shacks made of rusty sheet metal without access to drinkable water, electricity, or basic sanitation. When it rains, their homes flood and residents bail out mud and water. The Red Cross received an outpouring of donations after the quake, nearly $500 million. The group has publicly celebrated its work, but in fact, the Red Cross has repeatedly failed on the ground in Haiti. Confidential memos, emails from worried top officers, and accounts of a dozen frustrated and disappointed insiders show the charity has broken promises, squandered donations, and made dubious claims of success. The Red Cross says it has provided homes for more than 130,000 people, but the actual number of permanent homes in the group that the group has built in all of Haiti is six. So you can find that at ProPublica.org, and I bring it up because memory is very important at times like this, and I urge you not to give your money to Red Cross for Haiti anyway. I don't know how good or bad they are elsewhere. I would say that the Haiti debacle makes the whole organization questionable. Remember, please. And I would suggest, so you might want to say, well, where should I send money to help Haiti? Well, perhaps Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders might be a good good place to send your money. More on the hurricane in a moment. Portland Cop Watch, Dan Handelman wrote yesterday, it's hard to describe everything that happened at the city councils, at the council chambers today, but I can easily tell you, he wrote, what did not happen. They did not hold a hearing on the Portland Police Association contract. Several people began shouting down the mayor when he would not allow public input on an earlier item about housing issues. Eventually, the hearing was set over until today, Thursday, October 6th at 1 p.m., and speaking for myself, I'll be there with my little microphone. However, he writes, the handout states public access will be limited. The city hall staffers who were wandering around indicated that meant only a few people will be let in one at a time to the hearing. Dan Handelman writes, this is an outrage and needs to be corrected. I checked the city charter, and it says that public testimony shall be limited to the first reading of any type of ordinance, unless otherwise stated on the record by the presiding officer at the end of the public testimony on the first reading, end quote. And he writes, if I'm understanding correctly, the first reading is still in session, put on hold by the mayor last week. Apparently, 4 to 6 people who signed up were unable to testify, and the mayor plans to call those people up and no one else. However, since the amendment to the ordinance was made last week in the afternoon when many people who testified already were gone, we think the mayor should be taking more testimony Thursday as he should have done Wednesday. So, he writes, our action item for now is to recontact City Council today and tomorrow before 1 p.m., not only to tell them to postpone voting on the PPA contract until after Mayor Wheeler gets in office, but to say that if they are holding a hearing on Thursday, they must allow testimony on the amendment before they vote on it. And again, I'm talking about today. I'm reading from an email from Portland Cop Watch Dan Handelman. He writes, in fact, if he, meaning the mayor, had just agreed to take testimony on the amendment Wednesday, the meeting would have been over before the decision was made about 1:20 p.m. to move the meeting to Thursday. Council went into recess about 11:15 a.m. During those 2 hours, multiple police officers, including a swarm of Homeland Security cops, flooded the building. The front doors were chained shut. People were allowed to leave through the back entrance, but not allowed to re-enter. And once again, departing from this writing, speaking for myself, didn't I say Homeland Insecurity would be used to enforce the political will of the rulers? But anyway, returning to the text, he writes, he stayed in the council chambers as Don't Shoot PDX people surrounded Teresa Rayford to protect her from being arrested for failing to leave when the mayor told her she was excluded. Kiff Davis and Laura Vanderlyn were arrested, and Joe Walsh was excluded but not arrested. He writes, I hear that media was reporting that what was going on was a riot, which is bizarre as there was no violence done or threatened, except, of course, by the intimidating police. For the record, he writes, I have looked back at the video of last week's hearing, and what happened was the mayor introduced his amendment at the beginning of the afternoon session, meaning those who happened to be able to come back. The morning session ran from 10 to 11, was truncated due to absences of council members. They heard the amendment and could testify to it. This is a very poor public process, not surprising given how poor the rest of the process has been. And there's a little more to that email, but I'll leave it at that for now. It's 9:07. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This is Press Watch. Now, turning to international news, and with my thanks to Jack Holloway for directing my attention to an interesting website, moonofalabama.org, they write, is fighting Al-Qaeda in Aleppo good or bad? U.S. unable to decide. And part of what they write is there is currently a barrage of propaganda in the Western media in support of rebels in East Aleppo. It is all about hospitals and children, but the aim is to stop a Syrian army assault on the rebel-held quarters of the city. U.S. officials are again talking about intervention, meaning open war, to prevent the Syrian army and its allies from storming the rebel-held eastern parts. It would not work, but that is not the only reason why it is a strange idea. It is primarily Al-Qaeda that holds Aleppo. That's according to Colonel Warren, spokesperson of the U.S.-led Operation Inherent Resolve. That was back in April, and Al-Qaeda, a.k.a. Jabhat al-Nusra, has since strengthened its capacities in the city. The French Syria expert Fabrice Balanche tells Le Monde, Al-Qaeda's grip on Aleppo's east has only increased since the beginning of 2016, when it sent 700 reinforcement fighters. And skipping ahead, The UN Special Envoy for Syria told the UN Security Council, "We have seen information from other sources that tell us more than half the fighters present in eastern Aleppo are al-Nusra." And speaking for myself, in other words, al-Qaeda. In other words, supposed to be the bad guys, right? And we're seeing all this stuff about hospitals, and this is true. People have hospitals hidden under the rubble, and they're trying to do what they can to help everyone, to help fighters and civilians. And yes, these are al-Qaeda fighters. Returning to the article, so why does the U.S. want to stop the Syrian government forces in their attempt to free parts of the city, which are undoubtedly held by al-Qaeda? The U.S. voted yes on several UN Security Council resolutions that demand to fight al-Qaeda and to eradicate the safe haven they have established over significant parts of Syria. Following the UNSC demand, Syria and its allies have surrounded the al-Qaeda-held parts of East Aleppo. They currently bomb targets of opportunity, take starting positions all around it, and prepare to eventually storm and capture it. Measures have been taken to allow civilians to escape from the area. This whole operation, they write, is primarily in defense of West Aleppo, where 1.5 million civilians live under the protection of the government. Daily artillery strikes from al-Qaeda-held East Aleppo have killed and wounded many people in the government-held parts. But some U.S. officials believe that defeating al-Qaeda in East Aleppo will be useful for al-Qaeda. It gets more complex and more bizarre. But basically, what they're writing is that the U.S. is aiding the fundamentalist Islamic fighters. And the situation is worse because this is being used to back off Russia. But more than that, the U.S. is getting very aggressive towards Russia. And the Russians are responding by saying that if the U.S. is going to go to total war in Syria, they have thousands of their Spetsnaz, they have thousands of elite fighters they can send in. And they have S-300 anti-ballistic missile systems that they can send in to knock out U.S. cruise missiles, etc., and U.S. planes. So the situation in Syria is getting worse and worse. The U.S. is supporting absolutely the worst Islamic fundamentalists. The Russians are beginning to feel that they must escalate if the U.S. is going to escalate. It's a matter of a divided city, east versus west. And basically, coverage in the U.S. has been scant and or confusing. So to summarize, war in Syria getting worse, threatening to become a war between the U.S. and Russia. And when you hear fighting a nuclear war, that's a misnomer. There isn't going to be any fighting a nuclear war. You and I will simply die. There's been a reduction in the nuclear arsenal worldwide, I'm glad to say. But we're still talking about tens of thousands of weapons. And here in Portland, in the Portland metro area, war with Russia, you can expect at least, between half a dozen and a dozen nuclear weapons to rain down on the area. You won't feel, I'm glad to say, the last 11 of them. This would be incineration and death. There's no such thing as winning a nuclear war. Now, there are vast and extensive bunkers, especially on the East Coast, where the people who start and maintain a nuclear war will survive. And a very, very few humans will survive for some years, probably, once they start something like this. And they will be the elite of the elite, and they'll be able to congratulate themselves on how smart they are. We'll be long gone. So I would suggest that, to the extent that you communicate with our leaders, you might want to indicate that starting up a war with Russia in order to support al-Qaeda might be a bad idea. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And I'll be here for another 15 minutes. I want to talk about Hurricane Matthew. The latest is that Hurricane Matthew is heading for Florida, heading for Palm Beach. And Let me see if I can get the latest public advisory on that. And as I pull it up on the, you can find it on nhc.noaa.gov, G-O-V. And they have the latest advisories. This is Matthew Advisory number 34. Hurricane warning has been extended northward to Edisto Beach, South Carolina. So this hurricane, which is now over the Bahamas, is threatening the East Coast. Hurricane warning is in effect for central Bahamas, north of Golden Beach, Florida, to Edisto Beach, South Carolina, and Lake Okeechobee. They write the eye of Hurricane Matthew. The latest was located near latitude 25.1. Longitude 77.8 west. Eye is moving towards the northwest near 14 miles per hour, which is a speed up, between Andros Island and Nassau in the Bahamas. This general motion is expected to continue today with a turn towards the north-northwest tonight or early Friday. On the forecast track, Matthew should cross the northwestern Bahamas later today and move close to or over the east coast of the Florida Peninsula through Friday night. Reports from an Air Force plane indicate that the maximum sustained winds are 140 miles per hour with higher gusts. Matthew is a Category 4 hurricane. Some additional strengthening is possible, and Matthew should remain a Category 4 hurricane while it approaches the Florida coast. Hurricane force winds extend outward up to 60 miles, and tropical storm force winds extend outward up to 160 miles. This thing's down to 940 millibars. An interesting note, they add that if you are in a high building, that you can expect much higher winds up about 10 floors. Of course, this is interesting not just because it is a headline event and a dangerous hurricane, but because it is a global warming hurricane. And if you're listening to Democracy Now!, you heard about that. Want to pass on part of robertscribler.com's writings on it. That's just as you might expect to spell it, robertscribler.com. He writes, Hurricane Matthew has been a storm for the record books. Matthew was the lowest latitude Cat 5 storm to form on record in the Atlantic Basin, an achievement that bears testament to the amount of heat energy the storm was feeding on, as higher latitude storms can better leverage the Earth's spin to increase wind speed. It was the longest lasting Category 4 to 5 storm on record in the Caribbean, and it produced the highest accumulated cyclone energy of any hurricane on record for that sea. So, speaking for myself, this is another record-breaking hurricane, and of course, this is a direct result, a very obvious visual and direct result of global warming. Those two words you will not hear very often on coverage, on commercial coverage of the hurricane. This powerful hurricane, he writes, has consistently fed on sea surface temperatures in the range of 29 to 30 degrees Celsius. That's 84 to 86 degrees Fahrenheit. These waters are 1 to 3 degrees Celsius above 20th century averages and are at or near record hot levels. Furthermore, added heat at the ocean surface has led to greater evaporation, which has contributed to 75% relative humidity readings at the middle levels of the atmosphere. Such high levels of heat and atmospheric moisture are not normal. They provide an excessive amount of fuel for powering intense hurricanes like Matthew, and all this heat and moisture is now made more readily available by a record-hot global environment resulting from the ever-rising levels of greenhouse gases in the Earth's atmosphere due to fossil fuel burning. Yesterday, this heat-fueled storm vented its fury first on Haiti and then on Cuba, but as the rains fell at rates up to 5 inches per hour and the winds howled in at 145 miles per hour, the mountainous terrain of these two islands took its toll on Matthew's circulation. According to Dr. Jeff Masters, Matthew's eye wall was disrupted and partially collapsed as the storm tracked over rugged eastern Cuba. As a result, its peak intensity dropped off from 145 miles per hour early Tuesday to around 115 or a minimal Category 3 storm during the morning on Wednesday. And interrupting this text again, it's now back up to 145 miles an hour. But Matthew, he writes, has since reemerged as a major hurricane over very warm waters near the Bahamas, and it is again drawing on nearly unprecedented supply of ocean heat and atmospheric moisture. As a result, the storm is rapidly re-strengthening. Thunderstorms around the center are rising again to towering heights. Pressures are dropping and peak wind speeds are starting to pick up. This goes on to predict exactly what is happening this morning. If you pull up nhc.noaa.gov, you can find what they call satellite products. And that will give you some idea of what you're looking at. The interesting thing is how rapidly the image rotates and how defined the eye of the hurricane is. And looking at the latest what they call long rainbow top floater satellite image, I can see that the eye was very well defined as it passed through the Bahamas. It's just now passing, the eye is just now passing over the Bahamas landmass. And I don't know the Bahamas well enough to know which island that it is. And is getting ready to enter that body of water between the Bahamas and Florida on its east coast. And it's huge. And you can see from the false color imagery that it's quite ferocious. Headed there, and that, of course, will be what our news cycle will be about for the next few days. It may be more than just the next couple of days, but I'll give you those details from Robert Scribler's writings. He quotes the, he writes that Matthew's predicted track could bring major hurricane conditions to numerous East Coast communities. And of course, this is coming true as he had written. He wrote, Matthew is predicted to run parallel to the coast with part of its circulation remaining over water. As a result, the storm could maintain intensity even as it drives hurricane force winds and strong storm surges into multiple cities and towns along the coast. The subtropical ridge over the western Atlantic is still strong, and the flow pattern around this ridge should continue to steer the hurricane towards the northwest during the next day or so, with no significant change in forward speed. And after that time, the ridge will shift eastward, allowing Matthew to move northward very near or over the North Florida east coast and then near to or to the east of the Georgia and South Carolina coasts. Such a path would tend to keep Matthew strong for a longer period of time. Departing from that text again, the fact that the latest forecast mentions Lake Okeechobee means that it's pretty much the worst trajectory at this point. Returning to the text, in addition, movement along the coastline would result in severe impacts ranging over a large region, not just focusing on a particular section of the shore, but running along the ocean front for hundreds of miles. It gets worse, but I'll get to that in a minute. Number to call 503-231-8187, and I have an anonymous caller. Hello, Anon. What's up?
Hi, how you doing?
Doing all right,
thanks. Sir? Good. Can you hear me?
I can.
Good. Sir, I just wanted to mention to you that you're mentioning two different topics that are actually connected, global warming, climate change, and the war in Syria. I think it was around 2005, 2006, Syria had crop failures in their wheat harvest for several years in a row. They appealed to help from the West, Europe, United States, whatever, and they were rebuffed. Assad's government was rebuffed, and they soon devolved into civil war, and they became a failed state. So bottom line is their failed harvest was due to climate change, global warming, and now we have a big war on our hands. We have refugees crossing into Europe, causing all kinds of destabilization, and it all leads back to climate change. Same thing with Lake Chad around Nigeria, Boko Haram. That is also related to global warming, climate change. Lake Chad is shrunk to its lowest levels ever, and Boko Haram is actually more powerful and bigger than ISIS. People don't know that, but Boko Haram is a huge threat in Africa, extremist Islam. And this is all related to climate change. And then what happens when the ice caps in the Himalayas start reducing? You've got 1 billion people on each side of those mountain ranges, China and India, who are going to be fighting over that water, without which they're not going to be able to feed 1 billion people each.
I think that's an excellent point.
Yeah, my point is that war and climate change are connected, and they are already connected, and they have been for years. And get used to it, because it's only going to get worse. I know something about this. It's one of my areas of study, and there is so much climate change denial. Now, the U.S. Navy is actually interested in climate change because some of their installations on the East Coast are being affected by it.
Yeah, their docks are getting flooded, and they have to raise the level of their docks. Well, thank you very much for your call. I think those are great points. The number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Talking about the path of Matthew, and Robert Scribbler writes, if the current forecast isn't rough enough, the long range looks even worse. Model guidance is now starting to form a consensus that Matthew may not immediately head out to sea. Following its first encounter with the U.S. East Coast, models are indicating that Matthew may loop back, possibly even striking Florida a second time by Wednesday, though highly uncertain the possibility of Matthew returning to the warm water environment that so greatly added to its strength initially before hitting Florida a second time was enough to draw some pretty strong words from experts. And there's more to that article, much more, and you can find it at robertscribbler.com, robertscribbler.com. And it is talking about the relation of global warming to this monster hurricane, which is now aimed at the East Florida coast. Time is 9:24. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Legal sales of so-called recreational cannabis have been ongoing in Oregon for only 8 or 9 months. It's a little longer than that, isn't it? Non-medicinal cannabis, reading from an article in binsource.com, became legal on July 1st, 2015. But sales through existing medical marijuana dispensaries did not begin until October 1st, 2015. Data from these initial sales are starting to become public and show that Oregon's new legal cannabis industry is fulfilling the promise of providing a boost to Oregon's struggling economy. Perhaps the best news of all is that the industry is generating jobs, according to the Oregon Cannabis Report, prepared by industry consultants. Oregon's cannabis industry will create over 2,000 new jobs in 2016. These jobs will pay $46 million in wages to Oregon workers. Most of the jobs are part-time positions with growers and retailers. Consequently, most of the jobs do not offer any benefits, such as health insurance. According to the Oregon Employment Department, its statewide survey conducted last year revealed that the average medical marijuana dispensary earner gets about $12 an hour, or $21,000 a year, which is about $225 above the state's minimum wage. Wages are in line with wages for all retail employees in the state, which are in the wage of $20,000 to $30,000 a year. That's according to the Employment Department's data. Now, I bring this up because we're seeing some, if you drive around town, you'll see some backlash with big billboards saying that, just basically saying in various ways that marijuana is bad for you. And I suppose that there are ways in which marijuana is bad for you, but I think the message from the billboards should be countered with the various ways in which this change has affected the state. It's not all good. You've probably heard of some rather shaking, that's not the right word, some rather upsetting robberies because, of course, whereas prohibition has ended in Oregon, Washington, Colorado, etc., it is not ended in all states, and it is quite profitable for thieves to steal not just the cash, but the entire crop, the entire product of a marijuana store, and then to take that to a state where there is prohibition and where it sells for much more. From RIPR.org, states that have legalized marijuana are contending with a new criminal tactic, smugglers who grow and process it for export to states where it remains illegal and worth a lot more. Colorado is the epicenter of the phenomenon, and it's popping up in Oregon and Washington, too. As Maine, Massachusetts, and Canada consider legalizing recreational marijuana, the question arises, will the Northeast see a wave of new age bootleggers? And before I read more, of course, the obvious answer to that is that if the crop were legal nationwide, then there would be no interstate profit motive for doing this sort of thing. But returning to the article, during the Prohibition era, it was whiskey being run from Canada or Mexico to the U.S. Now it's marijuana. It's being smuggled from Colorado, where it's been fully legal since 2014, to neighboring states and beyond. It's Andrew Friedman's number one concern. He directs marijuana policy for the Colorado governor, John Hickenlooper. So you can find more on that article at RIPR.org. And stay tuned to KBOO Portland for more updates, latest news, and what's happening with the police contract going down this afternoon, and with Hurricane Matthew, of course. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland, going out to you via 90.7 FM and other frequencies in Cascadia, and via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea. We'll be right back.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of AFFECT, a community event about the work, culture, and design of social change. The conference will take place October 7th and 8th at the Ziba Auditorium in Portland. AFFECT will feature talks from Spawn on Me creator and podcaster Khalif Adams, Ferguson activist and social impact designer Dee Nichols, Nadia Gathers from Code 2040, and many more. Again, that's AFFECT, October 7th and 8th at the Ziba Auditorium, 810 Northwest Marshall Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.